Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What songs fueled Black Americans' fight for survival, freedom, and dignity for the centuries when they were held in slavery? And how did those songs evolve during the long campaigns for equal rights and justice that have followed? As my guest today will tell us, music has been a central feature of African American culture from the beginning, with some songs composed to deliver one message to white listeners and a very different one to Black listeners, and others written as open and deliberate protests against injustice. Robert Darden is Associate Professor of Journalism, Public Relations, and New Media at Baylor University and a former gospel music editor for Billboard magazine. His new book is called Nothing But Love in God's Water, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. Robert, welcome to Think.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
I love thinking about the idea of spiritual singing with two voices. Slave masters allowed them because they sounded like they were about biblical times, but for the people singing them, they were about the trials of their own lives.
It's a fascinating concept that at such an early stage in American development, you have such a sophisticated double-voicedness going on. The spirituals were the only creative outlet allowed the slave. You could be killed for teaching a slave to read. You could be killed, and your family could be killed if you gave them a map. But they allowed them to sing because it seemed to be innocuous and it seemed to make the work go faster. And when that's all the tool they had, they turned it into this very rich legacy. We have about 6,000 known spirituals, and some commentators have compared them to the Iliad or the Odyssey of the African American population.
How did it happen that Africans brought on slave ships to the United States were converted to Christianity at all?
Well, they weren't for a long time. In fact, the slave owners weren't Christians. There are stories about in the 17 and early 1800s in the South where the churches were desolate. There was just nobody there. But when you start getting into the Second Great Awakening and we start sending missionaries, primarily Quaker but Congregationalist and others, to the South, and they start shaming the slave owners into providing the Christian faith, they do a really terrible job of it. They bring in Black and white preachers who stay on one theme and one theme only, and that is, slaves, obey your masters. But at the same time, these slaves, who are very creative people who had come from very creative nations in West Africa, were listening outside the white churches. They were listening outside the bedrooms. They were hiding under porches. And they were pulling together bits and pieces of the true New Testament gospel. And some people, like Cornel West and others, had said that the religion they cobbled together, a religion based strictly on love and on the love of Jesus and the worth of every person, was actually closer to the first century church of Jesus than the Christianity that the white people were hearing in the big churches down the road.
That's fascinating. So in other words, they made their own form of Christianity that differed from what they were officially being taught.
They did, and it's something that a lot of people have gone back to on their own since. It gets away with a whole lot of the rules and regulations, and there's a whole lot of forgiveness involved. And one of the nice things about the spirituals is, and the days following in Reconstruction, there's no revenge, there's no hatred, there's no hate, there's no attacking. The spirituals continue to hammer on the theme that you matter, and God loves you so much that your picture is on God's refrigerator.
The other interesting thing about spirituals is that a lot of them refer directly to sort of heaven and redemption later, but they convey this longing for freedom right now.
Yeah, I wish we could talk to some of the original slave poets who put these things together. There are those who think that virtually all the spirituals had this double-voicedness that had both heaven and freedom in the North. And there are others who say only select ones that we know about were actually coded messages. I'm of the camp that believes that at different places and different times, nearly all of them have been used that way. Some are more overt than others, and a few have actually been explained by slaves in their last years to historians. One of my favorites is Follow the Drinking Gourd, which sounds like nonsense when it's on paper. But once you know the key, that it's really a map for escaped slaves to get from the Tombigbee River of Alabama up north of the Ohio River, you realize it's not nonsense words. It's a very specific way stations on how to get there. Others, you can see, go down, Moses, let my people go, was used, some people say, by Harriet Tubman as a signal for the slaves to gather for the Underground Railway. Swing low, sweet chariot, the chariot being the Underground Railway. Frederick Douglass says that wade in the water was actually instructions on how to escape from the hounds that will be tracing and tracking escaped slaves. And then there's others that I listen to that I think, golly, that's beautiful, and it certainly has a redemptive message, but I just don't see how it could have been used as a coded message for freedom.
Well, let's listen here. We have, a later recording of the Fisk Jubilee singer singing Go Down, Moses.
When Israel was in Egypt's land,
let my people go.
Oppressed so hard they could not stand,
let my people
That was the Fisk Jubilee singer singing Go Down, Moses. One thing I love about that particular track, Robert, is that it's all a cappella. Was that the way most of these songs came into existence?
As best we know, they did. Obviously, the actual spiritual sound did very little like that. That's an arranged choral version done 100 years after its original inception. But as best as we can tell from extant snippets of stories about them, the melody is basically the same, and the lyrics are precisely the same. What we're hearing in the Fisk Jubilee Singers is something called, actually, Jubilee, where you arrange the old spirituals into the soprano, alto, tenor, bass format, like a choral chorus, whereas the original spirituals, which never sounded the same way twice, which were improvised on the spot, would be different one night in one plantation, the same song in the next plantation would be entirely different. They were never written down, and there was lyrics that moved back and forth among all of them.
You established something called the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project in 2009. Can you talk a little bit about what it's taken to try to collect some of these very obscure recordings when they exist at all?
And when they exist at all, unfortunately, is the key. I had written a previous book, People Get Ready, A New History of Black Gospel Music, and in the course of writing it, I discovered about 75% of the music I was writing about. Now, this is the music that's the foundational music of most all American popular music, rap, jazz, blues, rock and roll, was unavailable. You couldn't get it on eBay, you couldn't get it on Amazon. Many of the big collectors, and there's about a dozen worldwide, some of them didn't have it. The music's either tied up in litigation, or it's in landfills, or is lost in one way or another. And I wrote an editorial that was appeared in the New York Times saying that if we let this music disappear, future generations are going to judge us very harshly. This is the music that's the best insight we have into an African-American community that didn't have access to newspapers or TV stations or books or even radio. And so a gentleman in New York, Charles M. Royce, read that editorial and gave us a grant to help build what became the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University, with the idea to identify, acquire, either through loan or gift, digitize, catalog, and eventually, depending on how all the copyright stuff goes in Congress, make accessible this lost music. And within these few years, it's now the largest initiative of its kind in the world to this old, precious, fast-vanishing black gospel vinyl.
When that vinyl is in bad condition, in the digitization process, do you do anything to attempt to restore it to what it would have sounded like originally, or do you leave them in the condition they are?
We do a very light and very professional cleaning, mainly to keep from damaging our own equipment because it costs a lot of money, but it doesn't alter the music. We make a digital copy in an archival format and very massive files, just like you get it, with all the pops and hisses and the speed that goes up or slows down depending on the recording equipment. And then we do a second version where we kind of polish up some of the worst of the hisses and pops, and we use our variable speed turntables to try to make sure if it's supposed to be at 122 beats per minute, it's 122 beats per minute. And those are the ones that would be available on the websites as we go through the copyright control to make them available. But the original sound, as best what we have, will always remain in archival format.
One thing that you discovered is that a lot of single releases of popular gospel songs have these amazing B-sides that deal directly with civil rights.
Well, that was the impetus for this two-volume book, the one you mentioned, Nothing But Love and God's Water, which is Volume 1, which goes from the slave times through the Montgomery bus boycott. And it was as these 45s started coming in and we flipped them over, we were discovering not only did most of these songs not in any database, and the databases on gospel music are pretty terrible, and they're very few and far between to begin with, but a significant percentage had a very overt civil rights related message, like there ain't no segregation in heaven. And that intrigued me because it reminded me in a lot of ways of the spirituals, the double voicedness of the spirituals. Very few white people were ever going to hear the A side or the hit side of a gospel 45 in those days, in the 50s and 60s, and virtually none would ever hear the B side. Only the true believers, the fans, would hear that. And the artists could send these almost not particularly coded messages for the people who are most willing and wanting to hear that message at a time when they most needed it. And what intrigued me was, just like the spirituals, had one of the idiot overseers ever figured out that they were singing about how to get out of here, that had some of the racist and KKK members in Alabama known it was on the B-side, the artist who recorded it and the guy who sold it and everybody in a 10-mile radius would have been at jeopardy.
But the point was nobody in a position to do anything about this was paying attention because they didn't think it was important.
They didn't know. And, you know, most of my friends, the people who study gospel music, most of them didn't know because we're just now getting these 45s.
Where are they coming from?
Well, that's the great thing, and if I may put in a plug for your radio show and ones like it, each time we go on the air, somebody says, you know, there's a box of this stuff up in Grandma's attic. We were going to take it to the landfill. Let's contact this Black Gospel Music Restoration Project. We'll pay for the shipping and the insurance. We'll digitize it, catalog, and then we'll send back the originals if they want, and we'll make them an MP3. So about half the stuff comes from people hearing or reading about the project, and the other half come from a select few of the largest collectors in the world, primarily right now Bob Maravich in Chicago, who have graciously allowed us to digitize his 45s. And he has thousands and thousands of them. He collected them and nobody else cared. And we send them back to Bob, where he has the largest such collection in the world of the physical vinyl. We now have the largest collection of the digitized music in the world.
Robert Darden is my guest. He's Associate Professor of Journalism, Public Relations, and New Media at Baylor University. We're talking about his new book, Nothing But Love in God's Water, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho. Jericho.
Oh, yeah.
and the wolves come a-tumbling down.
You may talk about your king of Gideon, you may talk about your man of Saul. There's none like good old Joshua at Battle of Jericho. Up to the walls of Jericho, he marched with spear in hand. Go blow them rams on Joshua cried, 'cause the bad lamb in my hand. Then the lamb ram sheep horns begin to blow, trumpets begin to sound. Joshua commanded the children to shout, and the walls come a-tumbling down.
That morning,
Joshua fit the battle of Jericho,
That is Paul Robeson singing Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho. My guest this hour is Robert Darden, Associate Professor of Journalism, Public Relations, and New Media at Baylor, and author of the new book Nothing But Love in God's Water, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. You have to love Robeson's voice. I did not realize until I read your book. I knew that he was a big star, but he was sort of good at everything he touched. And perhaps could have separated himself from the fight for black justice in America, but in fact it was central to his career.
He did, and it's amazing that he wasn't killed. The man was extraordinarily brave at a time when very few people, black or white, had that kind of courage.
And he was traveling all throughout the world, and in many cases, you say, he was the first black performer to arrive on the stages where he would sing and act.
And he was a hero in a lot of other countries, and part of what got him in trouble was one of the few things the Soviet Union admired about the United States was the singing of Paul Robeson, and it caused him grief to the end of his life.
What's interesting about that piece that he sang, I don't have the exact date of the recording, but I'm guessing that might have been in the 1930s?
Early 40s, yeah.
Okay. And it sounds like a throwback, like he was deliberately sort of reaching back to the earlier days of the traditions and keeping these songs alive.
Yeah, he had a great respect and apparently spent a lot of time talking with the freed slaves, some of the few that were still alive in those days, trying to recapture what indeed the music sounded like. Obviously, we don't have any recordings. The Lomaxes made a few recordings of tiny little black churches in backwoods Alabama and Mississippi that give us a flavor of what the old spirituals may have sounded like. But the basic essentials, the call and response, the love of improvisation, the use of biblical themes, the flatted sevenths and thirds of the blue notes and such remain potent in American popular music today. It has really unchanged since they first arrived in this country from Africa.
Certainly there are standards like the song we just heard that were sung in similar ways from place to place. But I love the idea that because initially a lot of the spirituals were not written down, people felt free to adapt them to what they were dealing with, to the way they understood things. And so the songs had all these different iterations depending on where you went.
And that's part of what I hope I'm showing in these two volumes is this almost apostolic succession that takes us from the spirituals right up until the umbrella movement in Hong Kong and the singing in the streets in Ferguson. It's the same songs. Now, the words may be moved around and they may be set to that location. But one of the fascinating things about Volume 1 for me was learning about the intersection between the spirituals and the labor movement. Labor, as you know, had a 200-year history of labor songs and union songs. When they finally allow African Americans into the unions in the 1930s and 1940s, very quickly the two things come together, and you hear old gospel songs like spirituals like In That Great Getting Up Morning becomes In That Great Union Morning. And they're marching and singing and protesting even as the federal government is calling out troops in Flint, Michigan to slaughter them as they try to cross the bridge to the Ford plant.
And we get the sense that these songs, and we'll talk about this as we talk about civil rights as well, but they were not just about communicating sort of on the spot in the moment with people who might witness the protest. They were also about sort of girding the loins of people who were there to do the protest.
Part of what's been frustrating, I just said what was good about the book, a frustrating thing is to try to pull all that together in the conclusion, which is where I am now, as to what all did it actually do? What all was accomplished by this singing? And the thing that set me off on that was we were in Birmingham for a few weeks talking to the people who had gone to those nightly mass meetings, and each one of them said the same thing. Said, People start arrive at 3 o'clock for a 7 o'clock meeting, and they sing right up until the meeting. They bring their sandwiches and sit in the pews. At 7 o'clock, there'd be a 15-20-minute instructions. I need 100 people arrested at 16th Street Baptist Church every hour, that sort of thing. And then there'd be about a 45-minute sermon from Dr. King or Shuttlesworth or Ralph Abernathy. And then the remaining 2 hours, they go back to singing. And here you are at a spear point in American history, one of the most important times, 1963, in all of American history, if you're an African American. The whole weight of the world is on the other side, and you have marshaled these few thousand people to take it on, and yet you spend most of your time singing. Clearly, something is happening that is being accomplished towards your goals. And yes, you're being girded up to go out and do battle again with the water cannons and the dogs, but also when you come back in after being beaten and hit and spat at and called names, the singing was to bring you down so you didn't fight back. The singing was for instruction. It was for the creation of community. It was for the creation of a theology, the religion that God blesses this. You are beloved of God, and God is on our side. And eventually we shall, not right now, but we shall overcome.
That is Mahalia Jackson singing We Shall Overcome. And, you know, Robert, you hear that recording and you think, if Mahalia Jackson tells me it's true in that astonishing voice of hers, I'm going to believe it and I'm going to, you know, sort of move ahead. The power in the way she sings and also the quality of her voice is really remarkable.
Well, one of the things that's been wonderful about this research over the last 9 years has been to find out the amount of time and money and at great personal risk on a couple of occasions, people like Mahalia Jackson and other gospel singers invested into the movement. They went places that other people were afraid to go. When you've got 1,000 people needing bail, people like Mahalia Jackson and Harry Belafonte and the Mighty Clouds of Joy either gave money or they did benefits to raise money. And Mahalia sings this sort of song in her concerts to white people at a time when it's not particularly fashionable to do so. She is not going to worry about her career. She is going to be in support of what she called the walking people in Montgomery and later.
Are there reports of people listening to this and white people and thinking, okay, I get it now? Or was she simply just doing something defiant, knowing that she would change no minds in that time?
I don't know. I really don't know. I'm hoping that the fact that here is somebody who is one of the most beloved figures in America, black or white, was singing these songs. And just like with every movement, you have 10% is actively against, 10% that's actively for, and the great middle, 80% that just doesn't do anything. It's probably true of politics and sports, I guess, as well. She's not singing to either of the two extremes. She has an audience, and a very unique audience at that time, where she can sing the old gospel songs and the old spirituals and the freedom songs to that great big middle. And maybe they're not going to give money, and maybe they're not going to march, but maybe they're not going to tell another racist joke around the water cooler the next day. And maybe they're going to say and write a letter that maybe we shouldn't be keeping American citizens from the right to vote if these citizens just 7-8 years earlier had been fighting and dying in Japan and Germany.
The story is that her voice is what made you fall in love with this music. Is that true?
This is what my parents say. Now, they're both gone, so I hope they would have told me the truth there near the end. My father got promoted in the Air Force 1960. I would have been about 6 years old. He used the money to go out and buy our first ever hi-fi player, a little rinky-dinky thing. And he still had money left over to buy some records and Perry Como and movie themes. But the third one, because apparently it was near Christmas, was Mahalia Jackson's Christmas album with her 6.5-minute version of Silent Night. And according to my parents, I played that record over and over and over again. And my wife, Mary, says that I've been spending the last 54 years now trying to replicate the thrill I got from hearing that voice for the very first time. Hmm. Maybe that's true. But I also know growing up in the Air Force, which was integrated by presidential decree before the rest of the country, I was in and out of the houses of my African-American friends, and this is the music that was playing on their record players as we became lifelong friends.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now to John in Wichita Falls. Hey, John.
Hello, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I want to compliment you and tell you that I think Glenn Mitchell would be very proud of you.
Oh, thank you.
The guest speaker there, I bet he listened to, he's got the whole world in his hands, too.
Indeed I did, John.
Yeah. I used to do music therapy in a hospital setting. And in February, we would have specials on black history, and we did spirituals, and especially the coded ones. About, you know, like there's a balm in Gilead and mm-hmm. Deep River, and mm-hmm. And of course we did follow the drinking gourd, but you know, I was surprised about the Ohio River and campground and Canada, you know, talking about all those things and the Underground Railroad, and I'm so glad that you brought that up because so many people don't know that, you know, they had no idea that what they were singing was actually, you know, coded messages. Now I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you, John. And it doesn't diminish the appreciation for them. Deep River is just a gorgeous melody, however you hear it. If you don't know that there were messages in there, the songs work on so many levels, and that's partly the reason why I think they survived. These melodies have been honed and perfected through the fire for the last hundreds of years, and they endure.
What would you say are the defining differences between spirituals and what became like church gospel music?
Well, the spirituals are always improvised. The spirituals never stayed the same. They were sung in a call and response format and could change as to the needs. Gospel songs, if this is your question, I understand it right, gospel songs are always composed. They may have the same themes, and in fact, many gospel songs are based on spirituals, but somebody sat down and composed a song that is generally designed to be in performance by a choir or a soloist in front of a congregation, and only occasionally is the congregation part of the song, whereas in the spirituals, there is no difference between the song leader and the congregation. Anybody could lead a song, and oftentimes they were just brought up in unison. Somebody would sing the first few words, and then everybody else would sing.
I was really interested that in the section about labor, the labor movement using gospel music as part of its sort of driving energy, there was a lot of like direct reference to communism in some of these songs.
Yeah, and that was a so much fun to go through. The only people who were covering the African Americans in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s at any length were the communist newspapers in the United States before that became a dirty word. Remember, we were on the same side in World War II. Mm-hmm. The Daily Worker and all of the other communist / socialist newspapers, some of which really were daily, they had weekend editions with comic strips. They were real newspapers. But they covered things nobody else covered. And I got to read articles by John Steinbeck and Upton Sinclair, who wrote for these as freelancers. And a lot of the information I have about what was in those songs and what was sung at different union sites, again, the mainstream media is not covering unions either, comes from those newspapers. And the only people who were fighting, outside of perhaps the Quakers, for the African-American in those days was the Socialist and Communist Party. And it's not surprising that sometimes the words would slip in. There's a funny little song about the seven seals, instead of John wrote the seven seals of the book of Revelation, Lenin writes the seven seals of the Revelation. And sometimes politics makes for some funny bedfellows, but they were working and dying on behalf of the black man when nobody else was, and give them props for that.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Obie calling from Atlanta. Hi, Obie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thanks for having me on air. I have a question for your guest.
Okay.
Okay.
I have been listening to the program, and I appreciate everything you are doing. I do have a question about the catalogs that you have collected and digitized. Does any of the songs include African-American work songs?
The grant that we got from Mr. Royce initially was just for black sacred music. Now, we do have collected some work songs as they have become available, because to the African who came from Africa, literally, there was no distinction between the two. Categories are shelves that we create ourselves in a lot of ways. The African who arrived singing sang religious, he sang work songs, and they intertwined without apparent thought. One of the survivors of that is Michael Row Your Boat Ashore, which is a very popular song considered a work song because in the days before bridges, that was the only way you got from one side of the river to the other, was through the little ferries and rowboats. But if you know the rest of the song, the next line is Hallelujah. The other thing that we're collecting that I don't think we really realized with the Black Gospel Project in the beginning was there is really no separation between black preaching and black music. And so we have begun an initiative to try to capture the sermons of African-American preachers from the 1950s and 60s when nobody else was collecting them. These are some of the heroes of the civil rights movement, and there is no place you can go to hear the sermons that helped change the world. Of course, King's sermons are collected where they are and a few others, but if you want to hear Shuttlesworth or if you want to hear Reverend Clay Evans in Chicago, you're out of luck.
Got to jump in. Robert Darden is my guest. His book is Nothing But Love in God's Water. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults, from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on.
That is Pete Seeger singing John Brown's Body. We're speaking this hour with Robert Darden, Associate Professor of Journalism, Public Relations, and New Media at Baylor University, and author of Nothing But Love in God's Water, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. We include Robert, as you do in the book, Pete Seeger here, because he was, of course, a great hero of the labor movement and other social justice movements, and had a great reverence for this Native American music.
He was there at every opportunity. He is one of the few white people that was at every major campaign. He marches on the Selma March from Selma to Montgomery. And at the very bitter end of the modern, that chapter of the Civil Rights Movement in Washington, D.C., ankle deep in mud at Resurrection City, they had a little tent where they gave music, and Pete and Peggy Seeger were there. He thought this was the great American folk music, and everywhere he went, he wrote down the versions of the freedom songs and the protest spirituals he was hearing. And some of the research that I have is indebted to the fact that he was like High John the Conqueror. He was the spirit that was everywhere disseminating the music and disseminating hope.
And it's interesting because it sounds really different in his voice. It still works, but it does also, I would imagine it drove a lot of people to go back to the source material and hear that for themselves.
He was a great champion, not just of gospel and spirituals, but all kinds of folk music, being the true, authentic voice of the people. And he had, particularly during the folk music boom, a huge platform. And like Paul Robeson, he stood up to the government and to Joseph McCarthy, and he was banned off the airways for a year, but he continued the good fight right up into his death in the last year or so.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Ray in Dallas. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Yes, thank you for the program. I enjoy it very much. I was just wondering if Dr. Darden could comment about the works. In other words, I know that at Fisk University, there were two brothers and I think a son who I know published some spirituals and so forth, and I've heard that they were very influential and actually, in essence, saving spirituals, that they were going to be, they were nearly forgotten, and certainly serious musicians would never catch them, would never recognize a spiritual as a serious work of music. And I wondered if you certainly, and I'm sure you did, refer to their work and their compilations and so forth. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Ray.
The works were indeed essential, and I do devote a great deal of time to them. At a time when it was tough enough being an African-American classical composer to go back to the music of the slaves and to try to legitimize it and to have it published and to do arrangements that are still being sung today. And they continued and helped found and continue the Fisk Jubilee Singers, which still exist today. And the writings of the works continue to be of importance to scholars in other ways. In Volume 2, he talks about that one of the most important things about the spirituals and later freedom songs was that a single note of hate would have jarred all the angels of heaven, and that you can't have that in here and have this music to be effective. And I think King and the great leaders of the movement knew that and continued, as they praised the music, to continue to say it has to be in the nonviolent arena. It has to be only positive. Otherwise, God won't bless this.
A conversation like this would not be complete without talking about the very haunting song, Strange Fruit. And before we do that, let's listen to a live recording that Billie Holiday did.
Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh.
Billie Holiday there singing Strange Fruit. Robert, obviously when we hear a song like that, there is no coding, there is no hiding what this song is about, and therefore it was incredibly brave of a black woman to sing so brazenly about this evil thing that was happening all over the country. Were there repercussions for her?
I'm not sure. Now that you mentioned that, I should have followed through. Her career was up and down to begin with, partly for her own demons and partly because of racism. That she records that after hearing it, just read to her the same night the first time. And it has entered into the annals of black sacred music, which is why I use that as a title, because things like John Brown's Body is not a spiritual, and Strange Fruit is not a spiritual, and some of the labor songs that were used by the civil rights movement like we shall not be moved and which side are you on aren't truly spirituals. But at the same time, they're sacred, and they have been used as black sacred music for a number of redemptive sources. Ever since, there was a small group of people primarily in and around New York in the late 1930s and early 40s that enabled this music to flourish and to survive and to protect the artists from repercussion, knowing that once they got south of the Mason-Dixon line, they were fair game again. I got chills listening to it once again, and as you may have read in the paper, there was a big brouhaha over a PR firm, I think in Austin, that used that as their titles because somebody doesn't read their history.
Hmm. They used it as the name of the PR firm?
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. No, I unfortunately missed that news story.
It is no longer the name of the PR. two young ladies in Austin.
I hope that branding is not their specialization.
Not anymore.
Can you talk about the ways that this music is still, has found its way into popular music today? Is it still around? You hear it being sort of referred to by younger artists?
You do by the ones who have a sense of history and a sense of their own identity. You hear the Roots talk about it, and you hear the Stevie Wonder talk about it. I don't know that all of the rap artists would necessarily know it. I've heard Kanye West discuss the power of this music. But more important than popular artists hearing it and singing it is that it continues to be used in demonstrations. If you saw any of the coverage of the fall of the Berlin Wall, some of the extended footage had the people singing We Shall Overcome. It was sung in Beirut. It was sung in Kosovo. As I mentioned, it was sung in Hong Kong a few weeks ago. It's being sung right now in churches in Staten Island. It's like this pool, this ocean that exists that you can dip into whenever you need it. And when the circumstances arise, the people who know it's there can call on it, and it can still be as effective now as it was 50, 60, 200 years ago.
Did Martin Luther King sing publicly?
He did. He did. It was a lovely voice. He sang a lot, particularly privately. And whenever a mass meeting was going on, his friend said he sang. But what he loved to do was go to Mahalia Jackson's house whenever he was with Chicago, and they would form a quartet, and they would sing the old, old stuff, include and always end, as they always did, with We Shall Overcome, which, by the way, is the only protest spiritual freedom song that I found that never was accompanied live by clapping. And it's because you can't clap because you must stand and cross your arms in front of your chest and clasp hands with the person next to you. But every other spiritual I have live recordings of is accompanied by clapping, and sometimes very polyrhythmic clapping as well.
Do you know, were spirituals, and I know very few recordings of the earliest ones exist, but did you know, groups of people pick the best singers among them to sing these things, or was anybody with a voice that was willing to stand up welcome to participate?
Both. Mm-hmm. Along the great protest marches like the one in Selma, there's accounts Pete Seeger has of different protest songs getting lifted up different ways, and if it was one that the people wanted, they sang it for 10, 15 minutes, and then a mile down the road where the other of the 20,000 people are, another one would come, and as many, he said, I would hear as many as five at one time if I ran up and down the full length of the demonstration. In the churches, there was often song leaders just before the actual meetings, but in the hours before and after, anybody could stand up and start one, or may not even stand up. And then there are cases at certain funerals and things where people are standing and all of a sudden somebody starts moaning or humming one of the songs, and it rises up naturally from the weeping congregants at Medgar Evers or the three young men who were killed in Mississippi. Nobody's leading those protest songs and spirituals and freedom songs. They just emerge.
It's interesting to think about what they sounded like echoing through the jails that some of these protesters were held in.
We wish we had more of that. Thank goodness for the Carowinds who went to some of the protest meetings. Thank goodness for a few people who went to some of the marches and took their little reel-to-reels or little cassette recorders. But to get the full effect of it, to sit outside at 2 a.m. outside of a jail in Birmingham and have freedom fighters who have been beaten and robbed sitting up because they've taken their beds away singing these songs. That must have been a transformative moment.
Tom in Fort Worth emails to ask where he can hear a lot of these songs in their entirety. Most of them, we found several online, but would you send people to a particular location?
Well, even the ones that are in their entirety aren't in their entirety, because the LPs that were released at the time could only hold 20 minutes max on each side, so they're almost all truncated. Thank goodness the Smithsonian Folkways has re-released many of these on CD and as MP3s. You can hear the Freedom songs that way. The earlier stuff is, as you mentioned, kind of catch as catch can, and there are things that people talk about that I give my eye teeth to find. George Corson, who went around the mines in the 1940s and recorded people singing this combination spiritual and union song, writes about it, writes books about it, recorded it, but his recordings that I've not been able to find are available.
Are there, when you receive these old, old records to digitize, is it always evident who's singing?
No, it's not always evident. So I don't mind not knowing every artist, because there's a lot of artists out there. What scares me is every few weeks I get an LP from a record label I'd never heard of. And
wow.
I've spent 50 years on this, which means there's another whole avenue we don't know about. My favorite thing are to get the records that were recorded by churches in these towns as fundraisers. And sometimes a famous gospel artist will sing on it. They can't tell their record label that they're singing on it, but they do it as a favor. But you can recognize a Dorothy Love Coates or a Shirley Caesar. And there are just a few hundred of these pressed. And when I get one of those, I know I've got something special, because that's what people sound like when they're not worried about recording or commercial considerations.
What's to come in Volume 2?
Volume 2, I'm working on if I survive, the conclusion now. I'm to hope to get it to the publisher when I finish my research leave at Baylor in the next couple of months. I would love to see it come out at the end of 2015, but more likely early 2016. It begins with the sit-in movement and the freedom rides, and it ends with Resurrection City and the Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C.
Are there different kinds of challenges for the two separate books so far?
Well, the great thing about the second book is I got to go to all these places and spend weeks on the south side of Chicago and west side of Birmingham interviewing the people who were there. There's very few interviews in Volume 1. There's just nobody still left alive, unfortunately. And even the freedom fighters are in their 80s. And some of the ones I'd set up interviews with on two occasions died before I ever could get there to talk to them.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I've got a lot more, 150 interviews in Volume 2, and then finally, we start getting some newspaper accounts, so a single paragraph may have 10 different sources in it, whereas in the first volume, I would have a whole page with a single source.
Robert Darden is Associate Professor of Journalism, Public Relations, and New Media at Baylor University, and a former gospel music editor for Billboard magazine. His new book is called Nothing But Love in God's Water, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. Robert, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you. Anytime.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Mashal Noor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Contact the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.